Just so you also, you know a little bit about me, I'm Mohawk Nation Bear Clan from the Six Nations Grand River community, situated in Ontario. I have family on both sides of the border. I have our people, where we're situated, the border went right through our people. And so there's a lot of issues internationally affecting our people. I have been asked by Amnesty International to work with them as their lead researcher and consultant on a report called Stolen Sisters, a human rights response to discrimination and violence against Indigenous women in Canada. And as part of my responsibility, I had to travel across Canada to meet with families of the missing and murdered women. And I did that nationally. There was another woman, her name is Giselle Lavalle. She actually worked on the cases in Saskatchewan. So her focus was mainly Saskatchewan because a lot of her expertise was in working with the FSIN, the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations, in their Justice Department. She had worked on the Stone Child issue, that was where the police had left men on the outskirts of the city and left there to die. And with my expertise, I've been working, I'm a lawyer, I've been working with Aboriginal rights issues for the last 10 years since I graduated from law school. And actually didn't think I'd get called to the bar, but finally made the decision before my 10 years was up to get called to the bar, and actually worked with a human rights lawyer. Her name's Mary Eberts. And we've worked together on most of the Native women's issues and rights. So that's my background, and what I wanted to share with you today was Amnesty's report. As an independent consultant, I was strictly advised by Amnesty to explain why. I'm not a spokesperson for Amnesty, but I am presenting their report and the issues that I had to deal with as an Indigenous woman doing this research. First, I want to start out with a quote from the report, and you can actually download the report from Amnesty's website, which is www.amnesty.ca. They have a summary of the report and the final report online. I just want to start out with a quote that began the article, and it's regarding our Indigenous women. Dan Smoke was the elder who had presented this quote at a healing ceremony that I had organized for their family, because his wife's sister was found murdered in Toronto. So the quote is, "It is important to honor the missing and murdered women. It is unacceptable to marginalize these women. The Creator did not create garbage. He created beauty." And that was the basis of doing this report for Amnesty, was to recognize these women as women rather than how the media has portrayed them as prostitutes, as drug addicts, as alcoholics, as basically nothing, or even if they were reported in the media at all. So that's that was the basis for having to do this research in that manner, is presenting these women as mothers, as daughters, as sisters, as aunties, and meeting with the families in that in their relationship with their loss, with the what has happened to their family. One of the hardest part about doing all this work was how emotional it was and how spiritual it has been. The emotional part coming from the families who have had to share their loss, had to share a very difficult experience, incident that has happened in their life in losing someone or someone who is still missing in their family because they're still grieving. They're still grieving over over their loss. And the report started out, and I had actually asked Amnesty to start out the report by telling the story of Helen Betty Osborne. And Helen Betty Osborne is a Cree woman from Norway House who was murdered in the Paw, which is another community outside of Norway House. And she was murdered by four white men. And it didn't take... It took a long time even before they had done anything about the murderers. Just from the report and an inquiry that actually came as a result of the death of Helen Betty Osborne was the Manitoba Justice Inquiry. They concluded that the Canadian authorities had failed Helen Betty Osborne, and that they criticized the sloppy and racially biased police investigation that took more than 15 years to bring only one of those four men to justice. Also, what was most disturbing was that the inquiry concluded that the police had long been aware of who was responsible, and that these white men were sexually preying on Indigenous women and girls in the Paw. But did not feel that the practice necessitated any particular vigilance. So as a result of this, and this was actually in 1991 when she was abducted and murdered, and the Manitoba Justice Inquiry was done not too long after that. So, the Manitoba Justice Inquiry was done 20 years after that. So it's been 33 years since her death, and 33 years later, her cousin is found murdered in Winnipeg, and her name was Valicia Solomon. She was only 16 years old. Her body parts were found in the Red River in Winnipeg, and I interviewed her family. Went to their community. I went to Norway House, which is about 8 hours north of Winnipeg, and spent a week with them, and visited with the family and talked about Valicia. Met with her mother and her grandmother, her uncles and her aunties, and found that it was very upsetting for them. One of the issues that had come out of what had happened to her was that the same reaction that the family got from Helen Betty Osborne was the same reaction that they got 30 years later, despite the recommendations that came from the Manitoba Justice Inquiry. So basically, when the mother called the police to report her daughter missing, and it took her a couple of days to even report her missing, the police came 2:00 in the morning to her home. She's got other kids. They didn't have the decency to come in during the day. They came in at 2:00 in the morning. and she tried to sit down with them in her home. And they didn't sit with her. They stood in her home and they started interrogating her. Basically, that's how she felt, because they weren't listening to her. They were pacing back and forth in her home and looking in her kitchen and looking on her fridge and not taking her seriously. And when the police left, she had another death in her family, and she had to go home back to Norway House. She was in Winnipeg. So she went back home and tried to find her friends who might have known where Valicia might have been, and nobody knew. And so she had to go home for this funeral, and when she went home, she advised her chief and council about what had happened, and nothing was actually done until 6 weeks later when they involved the other political organization in Winnipeg, the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. And the Grand Chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs had a press conference. And it wasn't until that press conference 6 weeks later when the police finally did do something about it and they started looking for her. But it took all of that in order for the family to get some kind of reaction. And so it was in the papers, and she was found in October last year. And actually, it wasn't all of her that was found, it was her body parts that were found. And so that was still a devastating part for the family because, not all of her body was there when they had the funeral for her. And just recently they had a memorial powwow for her. She was a powwow dancer, and they had a competition dance for her in memory of her. And that's how important she was to their family. And also at the launch of Amnesty's report, which was on October 4th, Darlene Osborne came to the launch and did her presentation to the media. So that's looking at just 30 years, three decades of this, when in actual fact, I believe that we're dealing with at least 200 to 300 years with this issue, because it's not a new issue. It is a current issue, but it's an issue that has historic problems that come along with it. And one of the before I did the work with Amnesty, I wrote a report for the Native Women's Association of Canada. And that was a report that went to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the violations of Indigenous rights. And he traveled across the country just this past year and visited with different Aboriginal communities across the country. But this report looked at the history of colonization and how it has affected Indigenous women specifically. We always do talk about how colonization has affected the Aboriginal community, but not specific to Aboriginal women, because in each Indigenous society, women have been, regarded as highly respected. And in where I come from with the Haudenosaunee culture, our women are our leaders through our clan mothers, and they choose who the leadership is in our communities. And the responsibilities and the roles that come with being an Ongwehonwe, Gagongwe means a native woman, very highly respected, or at least it was. We're still having to deal with the issues internally within our communities, because we've learned those patriarchal values, and have learned them really well. So that's part of the roles and responsibilities in being a woman, and the reason why. Looking at Amnesty International's reasons for wanting to specifically research Indigenous women is because of that difference in history and the difference in the relationships of our Indigenous peoples and Canada. And putting Canada on the spot to deal with the safety issues of Indigenous women and women in general, because Amnesty has also taken on the role of a campaign to stop violence against women, and that's what this report is part of, that stopping this violence against women, and specifically in this report, Indigenous women. The cases that, there were nine cases that were included in the report by Amnesty. Most of them are already on public record. Most of them have already come forward, have been in the news. And so it was easy to access them because they already wanted the public to know about what has happened to them. And we reminded them when we started how public it's going to be and how much this is going to hit the world, because Amnesty International is an international organization, and the Secretary General of the International Office actually came to Ottawa at the launch and recognized it as a global document and an international document, and that it will be presented in that way. So putting Canada on the spot as not providing the safety that it should be and providing some kind of protection for Indigenous women and women regarding these issues. In looking at international law, Amnesty looked at different human rights bodies that Canada has been a party to and reiterated the fact that Canada is a party to some of these conventions and that they have to take responsibility for what is happening. And there have been recommendations, there are recommendations in the report in looking at, acknowledging the seriousness of the problem, publicly condemning the high rates of violence against Indigenous women, taking into account all of the commissions, the law commissions, the public inquiries, inquests, pertaining to the safety and welfare of Indigenous people. There's been provincial justice inquiries that have made many recommendations to changes in the justice system and how it relates to Aboriginal people. The Royal Commission on Aboriginal People also provided hundreds of recommendations on what Canada should be doing to deal with the issues of Aboriginal people. And a lot of those reports have been shelved and nothing has been done with them. Also, one of the other recommendations is to support the research into the extent and causes of violence against Indigenous women. One of the things that we did find was that there were no statistics. There aren't any statistics regarding the violence against Indigenous women and the actual numbers. There is an estimate by the Native Women's Association of Canada that there's at least 500 Indigenous women missing or murdered. And again, that's an estimate. And in the work that I did, and also the president, the current president of the Native Women's Association, in the work that she did across the country last summer, was that almost every person she talked to knew someone or in their family someone was missing or murdered. And so when you consider that 500, I think, is just a small number. And also looking at the decades and the centuries of our women who have gone missing, even as a result of colonization. And I'll get to that in a minute. I just wanted to finish with the recommendations. Amnesty's recommendation was also to take immediate action to protect women at risk, at greatest risk, and that the government should ensure adequate, sustained, and multi-year funding to ensure the provision of culturally appropriate services such as shelters and counseling for Indigenous women and girls. Also, that the police should also work with these women's organizations and frontline groups to identify and implement appropriate and effective protocols for action on missing persons cases. I found that in the work that I had to do was to interview police who were involved in some way, whether they were investigating or looking at the actual, what had actually happened in the case was that some of them didn't want to talk to me. They called them and they never called me back. One officer who I was able to reach in Calgary basically said he didn't want to talk to me, but he wanted to know who my supervisor was. And he wanted, he said to me that it's not against the law to be a missing person anyway. And so those are the kinds of attitudes that are out there, and the kinds of attitudes that some of the police have. And also I would say that there are police who have done a good job in trying to investigate the issues in some of these families. And actually, in one instance, there were two really good officers that was helping a family in Saskatchewan, and the their boss actually took them off the case, and for some reason, and I don't know, and that case is actually going to trial the end of November. So that's part of the issues regarding the taking immediate action, and also providing training and resources for police to make prevention of violence against Indigenous women a genuine priority. I think part of the difficulties in part of police training is that they have the training, but it's not mandatory, or it's just some kind of course that's added on, and it's not taken seriously. And so that should be done in order to understand, and also understand the underlying issues regarding violence against women, and understanding the cycle of abuse that occurs, and also understanding the family violence, the child sexual exploitation, and the violence specifically against women and the sex trade. Because a lot of these women are treated with no respect, women who are having to work in the sex trade, and a lot of the police departments they don't review themselves about what their responsibilities are to the public, and these women who are on the streets are part of the public. And so they are not provided the safety that they should be, and so that's also something that needs to be addressed. And also addressing the social and economic factors that lead to Indigenous women's extreme vulnerability to violence, and that's what I had referred to earlier about how a lot of our women are having to deal with the marginalization and how they have to survive on the street or survive even in their communities. A lot of women are still having to live just above the poverty line, and maybe not even that. And so we're dealing with third world countries even in our own communities. And that's an issue that has to be addressed. And ending the marginalization. That's one of the recommendations that Amnesty has made, that all levels of government should work with Indigenous peoples to strengthen and expand public education programs, including the formal school system, that acknowledge and address the history of dispossession and marginalization of Indigenous peoples and present the reality of racism in Canadian society. And in order to address the history of colonization against, and specifically against our women, the Indian Act itself is one of the most racist pieces of legislation that exists in Canada, and it was created as a result of British policy, as a result of patriarchal values and differences. And in my research, in doing my master's degree in law, I did my research on international law and the Great Law of Peace. And so I looked at how law in general has affected our people, specifically Haudenosaunee people. And because we are a matriarchal society, and I know that there are a lot of Indigenous nations who come from matriarchal societies, our women has taken the brunt of that. And as a result of the Indian Act, it defined who an Indian person was. And an Indian person was a man, an Indian man, a woman who was married to that man, or a child who was married to that man, or a child of that man, sorry. And so that's how status was defined through the man. And in my research, I found that they researched our culture. They researched the strength of our women in our communities and saw how powerful our women were. And so they had to figure out a way how to demean that, how to degrade it. And that was how they did it. And so I come from this matriarchal society. I'm a Mohawk Bear Clan. My mother was, my grandmother was, my great-grandmother was, and so on. But under this card that tells me that I'm an Indian, under the Indian Act and the Department of Indian Affairs, tells me that I am an Indian. Under the laws of Canada, that I am an Indian under the Cayuga Nation with no clan. And that's my grandfather on my father's side. And so it totally disconnects our families from the original tradition, because the clan was determined by our mothers, and so it didn't matter who the man was. The daughters, the sons already had an identity and they had a responsibility because they have a clan. And when you have a clan, you know what your responsibilities are. You know what it is that you're what you're supposed to do from the time that you're born. And there was a process set in place. And we lived in longhouses. And so we were divided by clan. And so when we lived in our longhouses, it was all families that lived in the longhouses. And so there was teachings from the time that you're born, from when the time that you're a young person and an adult and an elder, so that you have these responsibilities. And you're told these responsibilities, and so your social network was already created for you, that this is what your role is. And what has happened is that that has been torn away from us. It's been taken away and stolen from us. And remarkably, our communities have still maintained it. I can still talk here and tell you that it still exists. We still have our traditional government, and we still have our clan system, despite 500 years of all of this effects. And I'm proof. I know now that I am a grandmother, and I can see now why we had lived that way, because of the responsibilities. My daughter is 21, and my grandchildren are 3 and 1. And so now I tell her she can't move. She can't leave my home until I know that they're safe. And now I can see why we live like that, because of the children, that we were responsible for those children, because they are our future. They are who we are in the future. And I can also see how our ancestors did what they did hundreds of years ago to make sure things are good for us now. And so that's part of my responsibility now, is to maintain that I really take that seriously, that my responsibility is to make sure that what I do now affects the future. And so this work that I did regarding these Indigenous women is just one part of that. And when we start talking about the colonization and how much it's affected our families, it's really a deep hurt, really deep, painful, abusive system that has affected our way of life, and how much it has affected our men, and the responsibilities that our men was supposed to have in our communities and being our protectors. And so that has really affected our communities and the internal oppression that exists today, and how we really need to deal with those issues. So in looking at specific parts of the Indian Act, prior to 1985, if an Indian man were to marry a non-native woman, she became an Indian. If an Indian woman married a non-status man, non-native, she lost her status. And she would actually get a letter in the mail from the Department of Indian Affairs saying, "We will treat you like any other white woman." Basically saying, "You have no status, you have no recognition of being an Indian at all." And so the women were forced to leave their communities. And this, even when I talk about even my own people, my own culture, we have a border that crossed right through our people. And so even if I were to marry a man, a Mohawk man from New York State, I would have been considered a white woman because he didn't have any status as an Indian in Canada. And so it really takes away from our responsibilities as who we are. And again, I have to go back and say that we had some very strong women who ended up coming back to the communities and saying that's enough. And this was after 1985, the Indian Act did change, and that's what has been called Bill C-31, where they did take the discriminatory section out of the Act, but it created further discrimination, because now there's a second generation cutoff, where if, let's say, a woman married a non-status man, she lost her status, so she was forced to move away. Her brother marries a non-native woman, she gains status. And now there's layers of status. It's called 6-1 ABCDE and 6-2. And so her brother maintained the 6-1A, and his wife maintained 6-1A status. And their children have 6-1A status. The woman who, his sister, who marries non-native, she comes back as a 6-1C, and her children are 6-2. And so there's still an inequality between them. And so the cutoff comes when a 6-2 marries a non-status or another 6-2. It's very confusing, and it took a long time even for me to figure out what they were talking about in it. But it has created further discrimination, and a lot of those women who were forced to leave their communities generations ago really lost connections to her community if she was forced. And I was talking to some women just day before yesterday from PEI, who said that a lot of the women moved to the States. And so, you know, totally disconnected, and nobody knows where they've gone. So that's another how many women are missing as a result of the Indian Act. The other issue regarding the Indian Act is residential school. And residential school was also a means of assimilation and cultural genocide, because they forced Indian kids to go to school in these boarding schools, and it was against the law if their parents didn't send them. They were actually in the Indian Act said that they would be convicted and sent to jail if they didn't send their kids to residential school. And the Indian Act has been in existence since 1876. So we are dealing with many generations, and it was occurring even before then with missionary schools. But the Indian Act legislated this assimilation and cultural genocide. A lot of our kids, children, my grandmother, physically, sexually, emotionally, psychologically abused these children in residential school. If they spoke their language, they were physically beaten. And there are horrendous stories of what has happened to these people in residential school. And some of it is just so horrendous, and just the way that they treated women in residential school, used them as sexual toys, as a lot of them had to have abortions and were forced to do many things in residential school that I know my grandmother refused to even talk about it, and it was she refused to even be Mohawk. That's how much it affected her, and how much I know that has affected our family. And so that's an example. And so what happened in residential school is when these children were supposed to go in these schools from the age of 5 to 16, and so when they came out of residential school, they would marry someone maybe they knew in residential school. And one of the things that was never taught was about family, was about bonding, was about love, what you usually feel in your family between each other is a bond with your family, and how you care for each other. That was never taught. And so there was always a struggle, and of course alcohol was also a factor in some families. And so it became a whole cycle, another cycle of abuse. And then we get into the 1960s, into the child welfare system, where a lot of the child welfare social workers at that time took on those patriarchal values and said, you know, if your child is being raised by your grandmother, that's not right. And that's part of how our culture is that's how we're raised, that's how we're taught. And so a lot of times our kids were taken away because they were being loved. And so there was, you know, this generations, at least five or six generations that we're talking about. And a lot of those in that time, in the 60s, they called it the 60s scoop, was that those young women who were in that ended up in foster homes, being abused in foster homes. And later found they're on the street. And they're the ones who are having to learn how to survive in today's society. And an example of that was a woman that I interviewed. She was only 4 when her mother disappeared. She's living in Calgary now. She had 5 siblings. Her mother disappeared in 1965, and there has never been any missing persons report filed with her. And her mother was from the White Dog Reserve in Northern Ontario, and she married a non-native man, so she was forced to leave her community. And this was in the early 1930s. When she was forced to leave her community. And so her daughter, who I interviewed, says she still carries the pain and bewilderment that was caused by her mother's sudden and still unexplained disappearance. She said that we believed for years that we were not any good. After all, why would a mother abandon her children if they were good? And so this is something that a woman is still carrying with her, the effects of that Indian Act system, and a woman who has disappeared and still never found. Another woman that I interviewed, she's now a respected elder and counselor working with Indigenous women in Vancouver. As a child, she spent 13 years in residential school, and she had a cleft palate, and she said she was teased by other children. And she remembers worse the abuse that she received from the staff. She was sexually abused, she was raped, she was beaten. And as a consequence, she said she lost her ties to her culture. She lost her own way of life, and she also entered into a life of substance abuse and living on the streets. And eventually she was able to pull herself out of that, but she had children, and her children ended up on the street. She says, "I myself didn't have a home. I felt like I didn't belong anywhere, and my children have felt the same. They don't know my family. They don't know my community. I've never felt like my reserve is my reserve. I just try to fit in where I can, and my daughter suffered as a result of this." And her daughter was a sex trade worker in the downtown east side of Vancouver, and she was found in a dumpster, beaten, severely beaten and found, but she was still alive, and found her behind the Friendship Center in Vancouver. And fortunately, her mother was able to help her all along the way, and she's no longer there anymore, but it's still a struggle. And I'm very close to these women now. I'd say all of the families that I met with, that I interviewed, I have a very close relationship with now, and in constant communication with them and supporting them in whatever way I can. Just some other examples of what has been happening out there. I'm sure most of you have heard about Robert Picton, the serial killer from Port Coquitlam. He picked up women from the downtown east side. There are currently 69 names of missing women from the downtown east side, and he's been charged with 30 of those. 30 of those women have been positively identified on his property. And of those 30, a third of them are Native. And so that's something that I had talked about in an earlier class and hadn't realized how much it had affected me when I started talking about our relationship to the land. As women and our roles and responsibilities and our connections to our land and the Creator, because they tell us that as women, we're the ones that are so close to the Creator, because when we give birth, that's when we are delivering that child, that spirit, and the connections that keep us on earth. And so during the ceremonies, even during birth, is acknowledging that. And that they say that that's the time when a woman can leave, can decide to leave if she doesn't want to stay here. But our connections are so close to the earth and to that child and that spirit that that's what keeps us here. And so when I talked about the Picton farm, because what's happened is that Picton has, it wasn't a farm. He had pigs on his farm, he had a wood chipper, and he had some kind of sex snuff movies going on. And part of what he would do is he would chop up the women with the wood chipper and feed them to the pigs. And so that's why they had to search the land for the DNA, because that's how it was done. And when I talked about the relationship of our women to the earth, and the earth having to be dug up to find out who these women were, to me that's just one of the most grotesque disgusting. There's not even a word to describe how painful that is. And for those families to have to know that that's what's happened to them. And so it's just one example of what is happening to our women out there. This is also happening in Edmonton. Right now, there is a task force that's investigating deaths in Alberta. Right now, the RCMP task force is investigating 40 unsolved murders and 39 long-term missing persons cases in the province of Alberta. And all but three of those victims are women. But we don't not sure how many of those are Native women. And also, I know that in the last at least 3 months, there was a woman found in a dumpster, burnt. Her remains had to be identified, and this is just in the last 3 months. And so that's another woman. There were also in northern BC, Highway 16 that runs from Prince George to Prince Rupert. There's a spot in there where six women have been found murdered along that highway. And it's now been called the Highway of Tears. And the Highway of Tears includes five Native women and one non-Native woman who was found murdered along that highway. And just to reiterate the fact of the difference in how non-Native women and Native women are treated in the media is that it was only the non-Native woman's picture who was put in the media. And it was actually her parents, her father, that enforced it. And they had the resources to be able to do it. And so what I'm saying is I'm not discounting at all what has happened to her. But what I'm saying is that there are five other Native women who were not given that same opportunity to have the media, to have the public know about them. Nobody knew about them. And actually, there is also an estimate that there's more than these six women, that there is possibly 30 women along this highway. And so those issues need to be identified and public. Another serial killer was in Saskatoon, and he was convicted in 1996 of killing three Indigenous women. His name was John Martin Crawford, and I was actually in university at this time, between 1994 and 1996, and there was nothing in the paper. There was nothing saying anything about the fact that there was a serial killer in the city of Saskatoon. And there is actually a book now. His name is, the author is Warren Goulding, and he is a journalist. And he is, the title of the book is called Just Another Indian. So a comment that he made in his book is, he says, "I don't get the sense that the general public cares much about missing or murdered Aboriginal women. It's all part of this indifference to the lives of Aboriginal people. They don't seem to matter as much as white people." And just based on the research that we've done, that's true. That our Indigenous women it's not an issue. It's not an issue that has become public. In as recent as March 2002, the Native Women's Association of Canada also launched its Sisters in Spirit campaign. And it's a campaign to lobby the federal government for $10 million to actually do this research, to create a hotline and a database so that there is statistics of the numbers and what has happened, the police that are involved, creating protocols with the police so that there can be a process involved in identifying and doing something about women's families who are phoning in. And the reason why it's taken away from the or moved away from the police is because of the historic relationship or lack of relationship of Aboriginal people with the police, because there is a lot of distrust. There's a lot of distrust, and that's been documented all across the country and been documented by the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, that the justice system has failed Aboriginal people. And so all of those recommendations that have been made all across the country, recommendations, solutions, everything has been already been done by those reports. And I can't reiterate that more because Canada knows they exist. It's just time to dust them off and start taking responsibility. Let's see. When I talked about some of the women specifically, I want to make sure that I speak about Anna Mae Aquash. She was a Mi'kmaq woman from Indian Brook First Nation in Nova Scotia. And I think everybody knows. Does everybody know what happened to Anna Mae? Anna Mae was... she was involved in the American Indian movement in the late 70s, and she was found murdered on the Pine Ridge Reserve in South Dakota. An autopsy concluded that she was killed by a single gunshot to the back of her head. Despite the high profile of her death and the intensive FBI operations targeting members of AIM, almost 30 years passed before anybody was charged with her killing. And he was just charged just this past year. And there's another man who was also waiting to be deported from Canada to stand trial in the U.S. And I met with Anna Mae Aquash's daughter and have also developed a very close relationship with her. And she talked about her frustration with Canada, because she had sent them, her and her sister sent several letters to all levels of the Canadian government, but the only response they ever received was an acknowledgement letter, acknowledging their letter. There was never any response from them to support them in their three-decade-long quest for justice. Denise has said that any direct contact from any Canadian authorities would be nice. The level of apathy from governmental authorities surrounding my mother's case is disturbing and insulting. So she, I think the legacy of what has happened to Anna Mae is also... very much part of this report, because of the lack of response and the lack of the respect to our women. In this report, there are 9 case studies. I'm not sure how much time, but I have quite a bit of time left. Okay, I'll go through some of them. I talked about Helen Biddy Osborne. She and her cousin, Felicia Solomon. There was another woman, her name is Shirley Lone Thunder, and she's been missing since December 1991. Shirley was a Cree woman and mother of 2 children from the White Bear First Nations Reserve in Saskatchewan. In 1991, she was 25 years old and living in Saskatoon. Her family knew that she was on drugs. And according to her brother, she worked occasionally in the sex trade, enough money to get by and to provide for her children. Late in November, she told her mother that she would be starting university in the new year and asked her mother to look after her kids. But she told her brother a different story. She said she had to get out of Saskatoon to avoid the police. And that was the last time that they had seen her. The family actually didn't realize that she was missing until March 1992, when the police had contacted them, or actually her lawyer contacted her, her family, her mother, when she missed a court date. Until then, her mother thought Shirley was just went away somewhere, which is what a lot of our women do, is they leave because they're dealing with things in their community that they don't want to deal with. And so they leave for a little while and come back. But then, as a result of what had happened, she did start to fear for her daughter and filed a missing persons report with the Saskatoon police that same day. The Saskatoon Police Service's missing persons policy states that the investigators have a responsibility to liaise with complaints and should request media assistance if necessary to help locate a missing person. According to Doris Lone Thunder, the police investigator was in regular contact with her at first. He was phoning every week for approximately a month and then phoning every 2 weeks. But she felt, or she did know, that the police didn't make any public appeals for assistance on the case, and also felt that the police weren't very supportive. After about 3 months, the investigator stopped phoning, and after 6 months, Shirley's brother contacted the Saskatoon police to inquire about the progress. He said that he was told there was no record of her being on the missing persons report. And the Saskatoon police declined to answer any of Amnesty's questions about Shirley's unresolved case. That's another example. In October, this happened in Saskatoon. October, another woman's remains were found in the general area where Doris Lone Thunder had asked the RCMP to search for her daughter's body. By the end of the month, the RCMP had unearthed two other women's bodies at the same site. The three women were the three women that I referred to earlier, the Indigenous women. They were all reported missing in 1992 and 1993. On April 12, 1995, a local newspaper quoted an RCMP as stating that the force was considering excavating the grove where the three bodies had been found, as he indicated that there might be more bodies out there. In almost immediate response, they issued a press release denying having any plans to excavate, stating that they had no indication there might be other bodies at the site. And after the investigation from Amnesty was then informed by the RCMP that there has been a recent search of the area conducted by the Saskatoon Police Services. And so this is an ongoing issue. That's another example. Another example is Pam George. She was also from Saskatchewan. She too was struggling with poverty, and she occasionally worked in the sex trade. In the evening of April 17th, she agreed to get into a car driven by a 20-year-old white man. And there was a second man. He was hiding in the trunk. Both men were university students. They had been drinking, and neither had money to pay her. So they drove the car to a field 2 miles past the outskirts of Regina, and there the two men forced her to perform oral sex. They then beat her severely and left her lying face down in the mud. Her body was discovered the next morning in a ditch. The media reports suggest that the police investigation initially focused on other Indigenous people and people living on the street. One Indigenous man was reported interrogated 4 times. And 1 or 2 weeks after the murder of Pamela George, the Regina Police Service received a tip from a woman who said one of the killers had confided in a friend of hers. So they were able to obtain those 2 men. And they were eventually charged with first degree murder. At the testimony, evidence had said that the 2 men also tried to pick up other Indigenous women before they encountered Pamela. At the trial, that woman testified that she had refused to go with them, and they hurled racial slurs at her, reportedly calling her Indian trash and a squaw slut. After the men returned from beating Pam George to death, they reported bragging to friends that they picked up an Indian hooker. Both men admitted hitting Pamela, but said they doubted they had killed her. According to a friend who testified at the trial, one of the men said she deserved it. She was an Indian. The case was tried before a white judge and an all-white jury. Little attention was paid to the victim, and apart from the fact that she was working in the sex trade. The Crown prosecutor told the jury that Pamela lived a life far, far removed from theirs, and they would have to consider the fact that she was a prostitute as part of the case. And the judge instructed the jurors to bear in mind that Pamela indeed was a prostitute when they considered whether or not she had consented to sexual activity. And the Court of Appeal decision briefly considered the prosecutor and judge's comments and concluded they were not made for the purpose of conveying a negative view of the victim to the jury. Amnesty was concerned that comments of this nature may reflect social attitudes faced by sex workers in general and Indigenous sex workers in particular. The 2 men were convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 6.5 years in prison. An officer who was working in Regina at the time did tell Amnesty that he was disgusted by the verdict and that in his opinion some of the people involved in the investigation and prosecution of the case saw Pamela as a sex trade worker, not a human being. He felt the treatment of this case reflected the attitude from start to finish. So those are the attitudes that we are dealing with regarding sex trade workers. One more, Janet Henry. She's been missing since June 28, 1997, and I interviewed 2 of her sisters. One lives in Victoria and one lives in Vancouver. Janet was the youngest of a family of 13. She, actually their whole family, all of them, the sisters, talked about how close their family was when they were children. And Sandra described the breakup of their family as being a nightmare because their father died. He was killed in a boating accident and was tragically killed. And so after that, it caused a whole process of breakup of the family and many things that have affected the family, such as alcoholism and residential school, foster homes. One of their sisters was also raped and murdered when she was 19, and another of their sibling committed suicide. So in the midst of all of this trauma, we still have a woman who's missing and whose family is still suffering. She was one of the women who called me after the release of Amnesty's report, upset, and still having to go through everything all over again. And the police actually contacted her to start asking her questions about her evidence, about what she had brought forward to the police. And so she had to go through all of that all over again and is having to do it all the time because there are always different police coming to her, different police who are investigating and asking her the same questions. And she's giving them answers. And she is going through a really, really tough time. And her son committed suicide about a year ago. And so, you know, as a result of all of that, she's still strong enough to come forward and talk about what's happening in her family. She talked about her sister Janet as being a very caring, brilliant young woman. Before anything had happened to her, she graduated from high school, she attended hairdressing school, she got married and had a daughter. But when her marriage broke up in the late 80s, her husband gained custody of their daughter. And her sister Donna said she watched her baby sister spiral after that. And she eventually ended up living in Vancouver's downtown east side within this low-income neighborhood. It's a terrible, awful place. I've been there, and it's not a very nice place. Place to be. Janet, the way that Sandra described Janet was that she knew of the risks that she had taken and the danger. So she did phone her family quite a bit. She phoned her brothers and sisters frequently to let them know she was okay. And the last time they did hear from her was in June 1997. And they quickly became worried about her when her usual telephone contacts with them ceased. Sandra and her brother went to the downtown east side to look for her. After a few days, they did report her missing. And because she did have a small amount of money in the bank account, they did fear the worst. Sandra believes that the police initially had one or two suspects in mind and did what they could to follow those leads. But she suspects that Janet is one of the victims of Picton and that they just haven't found her DNA there yet. And so it's very hard for these families still. Even though they've come forward and have talked a lot about you know, their pain and their hurt. One of the things that has come out of Amnesty's work and the work that I did with them was that somebody was finally listening. That they didn't feel so alone. That they really are hoping that something can be done to address this issue.